is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. There was a plea for civility last night as President Obama delivered his State of the Union address, beginning his last year-long lap in the White House.
Our public life withers when only the most extreme voices get all the attention. And most of all, democracy breaks down when the average person feels their voice doesn't matter, that the system is rigged in favor of the rich or the powerful or some special interest. Too many Americans feel that way right now. It's one of the few regrets of my presidency, that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better.
There was considerable positive and infectious enthusiasm about the future, though, in a speech long on Straight Talk about what is and what is not working in America, and a speech short on specific proposals.
The United States of America, right now, has the strongest, most durable economy in the world. We're in the middle of the longest streak of private sector job creation in history. More than 14 million new jobs, the strongest 2 years of job growth since the 1990s, an unemployment rate cut in half. Our auto industry just had its best year ever.
Not a bad resume. The White House promised that last night was going to be a non-traditional State of the Union address. Do you think there were any new paths blazed? Any wild suggestions to break from tradition? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, was in the chamber last night. How did it feel, Todd?
One thing that was non-traditional in the content of the speech, you're not necessarily used to the sitting president using a lot of his speech to take shots at the primary candidates and the election going on the other side of the aisle. But a lot of that speech were veiled references to Ted Cruz and especially Donald Trump, talking about xenophobia, refugees, religious bigotry, and even carpet bombing. The president made references to those things. Another thing that was non-traditional, John, you remember Kim Davis from Kentucky,
sure.
Right?
Yep.
The anti-gay marriage protester. Kim Davis was a guest in the chamber, and that's not unusual, but the way she got into the chamber was pretty unusual. Everyone knew that Kim Davis was invited, but nobody could figure out who gave her a ticket. It was a big mystery leading up to the speech. After all, what conservative wouldn't want to take credit for inviting Kim Davis? She's a media star. Turns out the Family Research Council, which is a conservative lobbying group, gave Kim Davis a ticket. That's how she got in. How did they get their ticket? We finally found out Congressman Jim Jordan, conservative, is the one who gave it to him. So mystery solved. That was a little bit non-traditional, kind of smuggling Kim Davis in.
There was a whole crowd of guests and lots of shots to the gallery during the speech, but nobody was particularly pointed out. That seemed a little bit of a departure. And there was a lot of buzz all day yesterday among lawmakers and people on Capitol Hill of what this non-traditional business was going to mean. What were people thinking?
Now, we wanted to play with this idea a little bit. I asked a couple of lawmakers what non-traditional might mean to them, and I caught up with somebody interesting. Dan Kildee is from Michigan. He's a congressman. He represents Flint. And, John, we've been hearing all about the poisoned, sure, lead-tainted water in Flint. Kildee thought, hey, you know what would finally get the right amount of attention on Flint and its poisoned water? How about pass out pitchers of it down the aisles? Let the president drink it. Let lawmakers drink it. Listen.
Take a big drink of water, or have your grandchildren come take a big drink of water. I think it would send the right message.
What would that be?
That people shouldn't drink water that's not safe for them. If it's not safe for a member of Congress or governor or some other public official, why should we think that it's safe for kids that are poor, that live in one of the poorest communities in the country?
Wouldn't necessarily have to drink it. Based on what we've been hearing from Flint, you could just look at it and get the picture.
Yeah, that's certainly true. You probably also know that people like Dan Kildee and others around the community have been extremely frustrated about the slowness of the response. And I think this was just his way of saying, hey, people, you got to notice this and we need action in Flint.
Well, I'm wondering how wild we could get with this non-traditional business. The White House was on Snapchat last night. That's unusual. We could get really avant-garde here, though, in the age of selfies and GoPro and virtual reality, Bluetooth sound, digital streaming, avatars. We could really go crazy here.
So, I mean, I was thinking you could put people in like Oculus Rift virtual reality glasses. They could see the president on Mount Everest or in the Amazon, or better yet, maybe in Ramadi or the ISIS capital of Raqqa while he's speaking.
That's pretty good. I say we have color and musical sensors that respond whenever lawmakers stand up. You could do blue for Democrats, red for Republicans, and mix the colors up when everybody gets up.
You do like a commander-in-chief GoPro camera on the president's head with a little strap. You can see that feed out over the crowd, all the lawmakers. You get to watch it.
You could subscribe by donating to public broadcasting.
Right.
We could make anybody in the gallery an avatar. Paul Ryan could be an Olympic skier. Joe Biden, what do you say, a pirate? Animate Nancy Pelosi and Dianne Feinstein as UFC fighters, Ronda Rousey and Holly Holm, all the presidential candidates. We just give them big digital avatar Uncle Sam hats.
Well, John, if you're talking eyes on the screen, though, I mean, everybody loves live animals. That's what it's all about. Baby elephant, baby donkey right there in the chamber. Can you imagine?
A live band direct from the Situation Room.
Last idea, two words, Aretha Franklin.
Perfect. Recreate that moment late last year at the Kennedy Center honoring Carole King, Barack and Michelle Obama rocking away. Aretha only improves our State of the Union, I'd say. Thanks, Todd.
Pleasure, John.
How does a final State of the Union address feel? Is it different every time? Is this Obama moment unique in some ways? This constitutionally mandated ritual with so much tradition associated with it, can you really reinvent the wheel with a speech to the nation that stands with so many other speeches in people's presidential memories? We're joined now by Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law and former director of speech writing for President Bill Clinton. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
What's a final State of the Union speech like? What's the tone, the feeling, the behind-the-scenes sense?
Well, of course, there's an awareness on the part of the speaker and the audience that it's not as easy to pass big new things and that the 8 years in this case is drawing to a close. For all of them, but especially for this one, this was, to the extent it was non-traditional, I suppose, it was that it was a bit more of a farewell address. Valedictory looking backwards, but also he really did not put forward significant new policy ideas, even ideas that wouldn't be addressed in this term. He had, I think, a pretty specific political goal, which was to sort of say to the country, hey, everybody, chill out. Things are actually going pretty well. The country is actually on the right track. And the wave of fear and panic that seems to sweep across the country so frequently is not something we should all do. That would be his ultimate meta message, I would guess.
What about with Clinton? I mean, was he across the bridge to the 21st century at that point by the time he did his final State of the Union?
Clinton was always putting out new policy ideas till the last minute of his presidency. A lot of them happened. A lot of them didn't happen. But for him, he made his arguments by the accumulation of these policy proposals. And by the end – in the middle of his presidency, when he was having these big fights over the role of government with Newt Gingrich, when the Democrats had just lost the Congress, he felt he'd sort of resolved that and could make bigger public arguments. So his last few State of the Unions talked a lot about a very progressive vision of entitlement reform, things that didn't happen, but sketched out big proposals. Of course, he had something to prove near the end that President Obama, luckily for him, does not, which was he had just come off impeachment – in 1999. His State of the Union in 2000 was his first State of the Union after the impeachment. So he had to show people he was still on the top of his game and, as was the case, at that point massively popular.
Or had any game at all. But as you say, the popularity was huge and not really so much the case with Obama. But yet I got a sense that unlike Clinton, the pressure seemed to be off here for the president. It seemed to be much more of a relaxed moment when with Clinton it probably wasn't.
I think that's right. You could even hear – I think President Obama's speech interestingly reads one way, but if you heard him deliver it, the arguments he was making that we're the strongest economy in the world – that we have the strongest military, that we're really not existentially threatened by something like ISIS, was powerful, almost Reagan-esque. But the way he said it was incredulous that people could be as fearful as they are.
It was a, come on, guys.
Yeah. Get with it.
Yeah. You know?
So I think that certainly worked with his supporters outside the room, and it clearly was a reflection of how he feels.
Do you sense the hand of a speechwriter here, or did he do most of this himself? I really couldn't tell last night. I couldn't sense a style that was any different from Obama himself, unless somebody really, really knows him.
Well, so all of these speeches, the state of the, you know, as you know, before these speeches, every once in a while, people say, oh, it's an obsolete and defunct institution, and it's lengthy and boring.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Actually, it's still the one time when the country sits down and can listen at length to the person they have elected to be the president. For Bill Clinton, when he did it, he worked for weeks and weeks with all his policy experts and outside advisors, and he wrote and rewrote what the speechwriters, what we gave him, were dictating and making it his own that way. President Obama, by all accounts, works with a much smaller group of people. He's got a terrific speechwriter, Cody Keenan. And he actually works in terms of typing on a laptop
Oh, really?
Or writing on
a
page.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's his style. He has a voice that has not been as effective in making these sweeping arguments for his policy proposals. When he talks about the history of the country or the trajectory is when he's most effective. Mm.
And do you think this is a historical moment that we're not threatened by anything, folks, but we're driving ourselves crazy?
I think that's what historians are going to ask about this moment, that at a time when employment unemployment is at 5% and all these other factors, why are these endless panics and moral panics, whether it's Ebola or this or that or the fear of terrorism, which is, of course, very valid but not as big a threat.
Existential, not existential.
It's not nuclear Armageddon and the Cold War. One of the things that people may look at is realizing from a distance how much change is going on in how many people's lives, how unsettling it is for some, how the changing demographic nature of the country could be a source of endless tension or not going forward, depending on how we all manage it. And of course, also what you hear both in terms of Trump supporters or in the Democratic Party, that for all the aggregate growth that we've had, median incomes, the economic status of average people just hasn't caught up. And
well, it's an amazing tone to set as we begin this presidential campaign. Thank you, Michael Waldman.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law and former director of speech writing for President Bill Clinton.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.